Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the only podcast in the world where things are done the Hemingway. Today we're talking about Chapter 7, Part 2. Then we'll be reading Chapter 8. Again, some new characters are described. What are your thoughts on them? I am Norwegian said, while the descriptions of the new characters are slightly amusing, I thought the fact that Cummings went, oh, I want to tell an anecdote, so here's six new characters, one after the other, more comical. Yeah, the guy is a bad writer. I don't know if there's any other way to really put it, but he does not tell a good story. There's a thing that happens when I go to primary schools and work with 10-year-olds, where the first thing they do in their little short stories in an anecdote is introduce all the characters, and they just introduce them like, I don't know, it's a funny thing. It's like a video game is about to start and they've got to choose all the characters they want in it. And then they describe them. So they'll say like, Joe was funny, silly, tall, cute, and nice. And his sister, Jenny, was funny, cute, smiley, happy, and cool. And just a bunch of adjectives. And before the story starts, they just kind of introduce a bunch of people. And I have to sort of tell them more interesting ways to have a story unfold. Cummings does exactly that. He just uses slightly better adjectives. And it's just bad. No wonder he couldn't find a publisher. The only reason this got published is because his father was very influential and used his influence to get it published after it was rejected repeatedly. It really shows, I think, by this point. We're all seeing how amateurish this book really is. Swim said the Mumfish, said, my thoughts on the new characters being described. The laundry list of character descriptions is becoming mind-numbingly repetitious and monotonous, which, from what I understand, pretty well describes being imprisoned. Hey, you never know. Maybe he was trying to do a thing. Maybe the reason he's done it this way is to accurately portray what it feels like to be in prison with a stream of characters coming in and out. Could be that. I find myself uncharacteristically with less and less to say the more I read, says Tech-rific. Don't get me wrong, it's not bad. Some formulations, sentences, even whole paragraphs are great. I can see a poetic sensibility at work on the pages, but there's a reason poets write poetry. This is his only prose novel, correct? I think he had some other ones. I think this might have been his first prose novel, but I think there were some more after that. Anyway, since it's a depiction of World War I, I have to say there are other brilliant books on the subject. All Quiet on the Western Front by Erich Maria Remarque, for instance, shook me to my core when I was a teenager reading it in school. It made me realize what a human meat grinder that war was. The whole generation of young men and horses slaughtered for nothing. That war was a totally unnecessary war, horrific in its brutality. Read Wilfred Owen's poem Dulce et Decorum Est, and you can almost feel the mustard gas yourself as the reader. Even Parade's End by Ford Madox Ford, which follows a soldier before, during, and after the war, but I can't seem to conjure up much enthusiasm for this book that we're reading. Maybe I'm just reading it at the wrong time for me. The enormous room is filled with disjointed memories and fleeting characters, but none of them seem to stick in my mind with any permanence, at least not enough to trigger any coherent reflection. Nifty Riffic said, I don't know who is new and who isn't because some people are referred to with more than one name. The most interesting thing in this half of a chapter for me was the Count character, talking about painting and the paint colours, burnt sienna, cadmium yellow, and he couldn't remember the last colour, but I think it was perhaps Alzarin crimson, or maybe cobalt blue. These were always my watercolour staples. Anyone here paint, for conversation's sake? Prussian blue, apparently I glazed over that part. Swims to the Mumfish, he said, I don't paint, but I have heard of those colours. I tried doing some painting recently, and I'm bad at it. I'm really bad at it, but I don't know that I've heard of those colours myself. Nifty-rific said, I was curious why the Count warned Cummings about Prussian blue, and apparently the predominant colour of the uniform coats worn by the Prussian military was Prussian blue. I wonder if the use of colour would have been controversial, unpatriotic, then, hence the initial hesitation to mention it and whispered warning about it. Hey, that could be it. That's pretty cool. Swim said, the Mummifishy said, this book totally reads like a young man who was bribed by his father, promising a nice European vacation if he would write up his experiences in book form. I wonder how many of these characters and experiences are completely made up for dramatic purposes. Hey, you never know. All About Alice said, I think it's interesting how the characters are just a laundry list of information. When I'm reading about each character, I'm intrigued, but honestly, the second I've moved on to the next sentence, I've completely forgotten about them. Yeah. Techrific says, I completely agree. It's almost uncanny how it happens. Henry Laws 70 says, I think Cummins was just not a good writer. Maybe a good poet. He sounds like a spoiled rich kid, to be honest. About the characters, I assume they are real. At least the Mexican sounds real to me. But being a Mexican myself, I could relate to a lot of what was said about his character. I guess I am quite biased on this one, but it was the one that I enjoyed the most. Yeah, I think you're right about saying he's just not a good writer. Maybe a good poet, but not such a good novelist. They're very much not the same thing, you know. In my opinion. He does have some nice use of language, but the structure is just, it's not good. It's not good. All right, let's keep reading. We're going to read all of Chapter 8 today. Chapter 8 is called The Wanderer. One day, somebody and I were catching water for Monsieur the Chef. Catching water was ordinarily a mixed pleasure. It consisted, as I have mentioned, in the combined pushing and pulling of a curious primitive two-wheeled cart over a distance of perhaps 300 yards to a kind of hydrant, situated in a species of square upon which the medieval structure known as porty, or camp, de triage, faced stupidly and threateningly. A planton always escorted the catchers through a big door between the stone wall which backed the men's corps and the end of the building itself, or, in other words, the canteen. The 10-foot stone wall was, like every other stone wall connected with the Ferté, topped with 3 feet of barbed wire. The door by which we exited with the water wagon on the street outside was at least 8 feet high, adorned with several large locks, one pushing behind, one pulling in the shafts. We rushed the wagon over a sort of threshold or sill and into the street, and were immediately yelled at by the planton, who commanded us to stop until he had locked the door. We waited until told to proceed, then yanked and shoved the reeling vehicle up the street to our right, that is to say along the wall of the building, but on the outside. All this was pleasant and astonishing. To feel oneself, however, temporarily outside the eternal walls in a street connected with a rather selfish and placid-looking little town, whereof not more than a dozen houses were visible, gave the prisoner an at once silly and uncanny sensation, much like the sensation one must get when he starts to skate for the first time in a dozen or so years. The street met two others in a moment, and here was a very nourishing sumach bush, I guess, whose berries shocked and stunned I with a savage splash of vermilion. Under this colour, one discovered the mecca of water catchers in the form of an iron contrivance operating by means of a stubby lever which, when pressed down, yielded grudgingly a spout of whiteness. The contrivance was placed in sufficiently close proximity to a low wall so that one of the catchers might conveniently sit on the wall and keep the water spouting with a continuous pressure of his foot, while the other catcher manipulated a tin pail with telling effect. Having filled the barrel, which rode on the two wagon wheels, we turned it with some difficulty and started down the street with the tin pail on top. The man in the shafts, leaning back with all his might to offset a certain velocity promoted by the downgrade, while the man behind tugged helpingly at the barrel itself. On reaching the door, we skewed the machine skillfully to the left, thereby bringing it to a complete standstill, and waited for the planton to unlock the locks, which done, we rushed it violently over the threshold, turned left, still running, and came to a final stop in front of the kitchen. Here stood three enormous wooden tubs. We backed the wagon around, then one man opened a spigot in the rear of the barrel, and at the same time the other elevated the shafts in a clever manner, inducting the jet DU to hit one of the tubs. One tub filled, we switched the stream wittily to the next to fill the three tubs. They were not always all of them empty, and required as many as 6 or 8 delightful trips, after which one entered the cuisine and got his well-earned reward, coffee with sugar. I have remarked that catching water was a mixed pleasure. The mixedness of the pleasure came from certain highly respectable citizens, and more often citizennesses of La Ville de Ferté Macher, who had a habit of endowing the poor water catchers with looks which I should not like to remember too well, at the same moment clutching whatever infants they carried and wore or had on leash spasmodically to them. I never ceased to be surprised by the scorn, contempt, disgust, and frequent sheer ferocity manifested in the male, and particularly in the female faces. All the ladies wore, of course, black. They were wholly unbeautiful of face or form, some of them actually repellent. Not one should I, even under more favourable circumstances, have enjoyed meeting. The first time I caught water, everybody in the town was returning from church, and a terrific sight it was. Vive la bourgeoisie, I said to myself, ducking the shafts of censure by the simple means of hiding my face behind the moving water barrel. But one day, as I started to inform the reader, somebody and I were catching water, and in fact had caught our last load, and were returning with it down the street, when I, who was striding rapidly behind, trying to lessen with both hands the impetus of the machine, suddenly tripped and fell, with surprise, on the curb of the little unbeautiful street. A figure was sitting, a female figure dressed in utterly barbaric pinks and vermilions, having a dark shawl thrown about her shoulders, a positively Arabian face, delimited by a bright coif of some tenuous stuff, slender golden hands holding with extraordinary delicacy what appeared to be a baby of not more than 3 months old, and beside her a black-haired child of perhaps 3 years, and beside this child a girl of 14, dressed like the woman in crashing hues, with the most exquisite face I had ever known. Nom de Dieu, I thought vaguely. Am I or am I not completely asleep? And the man in the shafts craned his neck in stupid amazement, and the planton twirled his moustache and assumed that intrepid look which only the planton or the gendarme perfectly knows how to assume in the presence of female beauty. That night the wanderer was absent from La Soupe, having been called by Apollyon to the latter's office upon a matter of superior import. Everyone was abuzz with the news. The gypsy's wife and 3 children, one a baby at the breast, were outside demanding to be made prisoners. Would the director allow it? They had been told a number of times by plantons to go away, as they sat patiently waiting to be admitted to captivity. No threats, pleas, or arguments had availed. The wife said she was tired of living without her husband. Roars of laughter from all the Belgians and most of the Hollanders, I regret to say Pete included, and wanted merely to simply to share his confinement. Moreover, she said, without him she was unable to support his children, and it was better that they should grow up with their father as prisoners than starve to death without him. She would not be moved. The black holster told her he would use force. She answered nothing. Finally, she had been admitted pending judgment. Also, Spach highly excited the Balier. Looks like a who was the Belgian-Dutch verdict, a verdict which was obviously due to the costume of the lady in question, almost as much as to the untemperamental natures sojourning at La Ferté. B and I agreed that she and her children were the most beautiful people we had ever seen, or would ever be likely to see, so La Soupe ended and everybody belched and gasped and trumpeted at the enormous room as usual. That evening, about 6 o'clock, I heard a man crying as if his heart were broken. I crossed the enormous room, half lying on his pallets, his great beard pouring upon his breast, his face lowered, his entire body shuddering with sobs. Lay the wanderer. Several of the men were about him, standing in attitudes ranging from semi-amusement to stupid sympathy, listening to the anguish which, as from time to time he lifted his majestic head, poured slowly and brokenly from his lips. I sat down beside him, and he told me I bought him for 600 francs, and I sold him for 450. It was not a horse of this race, but of the race. I could not catch the word. As long As from here to the post, I cried for a quarter of an hour just as if my child were dead, and it is seldom I weep over horses. I say, you are going, Jewel, au revoir et bonjour. The vain little dancer interrupted about broken down horses. Excuses donc. This was no disabled horse such as goes to the front. These are some horses, pardon, whom you give eat. This it is collie, that the other it's collie. This never, he could go 40 kilometres a day. One of the strongest men I have ever seen in my life is crying because he has had to sell his favourite horse. No wonder les hommes in general are not interested. Someone said, be of good cheer, Demestre. Your wife and kids are well enough. Yes, they are not cold. They have a bed like that. A high gesture toward the quilt of many colours on which we were sitting. Such a quilt as I have not seen since, a feathery deepness soft to the touch as air in spring, which is worth three times this of mine, but tu comprends, it's not hot these mornings. Then he dropped his head and lifted it again, crying, crying, et mes outils, I had many, and my garments, where are they, put, ooh, kiss, and I had chemises. This is poor, looking at himself as the prince might look at his disguise, and like this, that, where? See, the wagon is not sold. I never will stay here for la durée de la guerre. Nah, bashed. To resume, that is why I need. More than upright in the prince, priceless bed, the twice-streaming darkness of his beard, his hoarse sweetness of voice, his immense perfect face, and deeply softness's, eyes, pouring voice. Has he had a stroke? What is? I think the author might have had a stroke at this point. It sounds like I'm not reading this correctly, but that's what it says. My wife sat over there. She spoke to no one and bothered nobody. Why was my wife taken here and shut up? Had she done anything? There is a wife who fait la putain and turns to everyone and another whom I bring another tomorrow. But a woman who loves only her husband, who waits for no one but her husband, the tone bulged and the eyes together. Ses cigarettes ne fument pas, I added an apology, having presented him with the package. Why do you shell out these? These cost 15 sous. You may spend for them if you like. You understand what I'm saying. But some time when you have nothing, extraordinary gently, what then? But better to save for that. Better to buy du tobac and fare yourself. These are made of tobacco dust. And there was someone to the right who was saying, tomorrow is Sunday, wearily. The king lying upon his huge quilt, sobbing now only a little heard. So, he was born on a Sunday. My wife is nursing him. She gives him the breast, the gesture charmed. She said to them she would not eat if they gave her that. That's not worth anything. Meat is necessary every day, he mused. I tried to go. Sit there, graciousness of complete gesture, the sheer kingliness of poverty. He creased the indescribably soft curvature of for me, and I sat and looked into his forehead, bounded by the cube of square sliced hair, blacker than Africa, than imagination. Than imagination. That's a sentence. THAN, than imagination. Full stop. Than imagination. That's not a sentence. Than imagination. After this evening, I felt that possibly I knew a little of the wanderer or he of me. The wanderer's wife and his two daughters and his baby lived in a woman's quarters I have not described and cannot describe these four. That the little son of whom he was tremendously proud slept with his father in the great quilts in the enormous room. Of the wanderer's little son, I may say that he had lolling buttons of eyes sewed on gold flesh, that he had a habit of turning cartwheels in one third of his father's trousers, that we called him the imp. He ran, he teased, he turned handsprings, he got in the way, and he even climbed to the largest of the scraggly trees in the core one day. You will fall, Monsieur Peters, whose old eyes had a fondness for this irrepressible creature, remarked with conviction. Let him climb, his father said quietly. I have climbed trees, I have fallen out of trees, I am alive. The imp shinnied like a monkey, shouting and crowing up a lean, gnarled limb, to the amazement of the very planton who later tried to rape Selina and was caught. This Plantin put his gun in readiness and assumed an eager attitude of immutable heroism. "Will you shoot?" the father inquired politely. "Indeed, it would be a big thing of which you might boast all your life. I, a Plantin, shot and killed a six-year-old child in a tree. C'est un meurtre," the Plantin encountered in some confusion. "He may be trying to escape. How do I know? Indeed, how do you know anything?" the father murmured quietly. "It's a mystery." The imp all at once fell. He hit the muddy ground with a disagreeable thud. The breath was utterly knocked out of him. The wanderer picked him up kindly. His son began with the catching of his breath to howl uproariously. "Serves him right, the jackanapes, a Belgian growled. "I told you so, didn't I?" Monsieur Peters worryingly cried. "I said he would fall out of that tree." "Pardon, you were right, I think," the father smiled pleasantly. "Don't be sad, my little son. Everybody falls out of trees. They're made for that, by God." And he patted the imp squatting in the mud and smiling. In 5 minutes, the imp was trying to scale the shed. "Come down or I fire," the Plantin cried nervously, and so it was with the wanderer's son from morning till night. "Never," said Monsieur Peters with solemn desperation, "have I seen such an incorrigible child, a perfect incorrigible child." And he shook his head and immediately dodged a missile which had suddenly appeared from nowhere. Night after night, the imp would play around our beds, where we held court with our chocolate and our candles, teasing us, cajoling us, flattering us, pretending tears, feigning insult, getting lectures from Monsieur Peters on the evil of cigarette smoking, keeping us in the state of perpetual inquietude. When he couldn't think of anything else to do, he sang at the top of his clear, bright voice, "C'est la guerre pour par terre faire," and turned a handspring or two for emphasis. Mexico once cuffed him for doing something peculiarly mischievous, and he set up a great crying. Instantly, the wanderer was standing over Mexico, his hands clenched, his eyes sparkling. It took a good deal of persuasion to convince the parent that his son was in error. Meanwhile, Mexico placidly awaited his end, and neither B nor I despised the imp's tormentings. Could keep from laughing when he, all at once, with a sort of crowing cry, rushed for the nearest post, jumped upon his hands, arched his back, and poised head downward, his feet just touching the pillar. Barefooted in a bright chemise, and 1/3 of his father's trousers. Being now in a class with La Homme Maries, the wanderer spent most of the day downstairs, coming up with his little son every night to sleep in the enormous room. But we saw him occasionally in the corps, and every other day when the dreadful cry was raised. "Allez!
Allez!
Tu le monde, plincher les pommes." And we descended in fair weather to the lane between the building and the corps, and in foul, very foul, I should say, the dinosaur-coloured, sweating walls of the dining room. The wanderer would quietly and slowly appear, along with the other Homme Maries, and take up the peeling of the amazing cold potatoes which formed a piece de resistance in guise of soup for both men, women, and men at La Ferté. And if the wedded males did not all of them show up for this unagreeable task, a dreaded hullabaloo was instantly raised, Les Hommes Maries, and forth would more or less sheepishly issue the delinquents. And I think the wanderer with his wife and children, whom he loved as I never have I seen a man love anything in this world, was partly happy walking in the sun when there was any, sleeping with his little boy in a great gulp of softness. And I remember him pulling his fine beard into two darknesses, huge sleeved pink checked chemise, walking kindly like a bear, corduroy bigness of trousers, waistline always amorous of knees, finger ends just catching tops of enormous pockets. When he feels, as I think, partly happy, he corrects our pronunciation of the ineffable word, saying, "Oh, Mayerdi," and smiles. And once Jean Le Negre said to him, as he squatted in the corps with his little son beside him, his broad, strong back, as nearly always against one of the gruesome and minute pommiers, "Babu, je vais couper du Babu, Babu," whereat the father answered slowly and seriously, "When you cut my beard, you will have to cut off my head," regarding Jane Le Negre with unspeakably sensitive, tremendously deep, peculiarly soft eyes. "My beard is finer than that. You have made it too coarse," he gently remarked one day, looking attentively at a piece of photographie which I had been caught in the act of perpetrating, whereat I bowed my head in silent shame. Demestri Joseph le femni felisca, I read another day in the gestionnaire's book of judgment. O monsieur le gestionnaire, I should not have liked to have seen those names in my book of sinners, in my album of filth and blood and incontinence, had I been you, O little, very little government of Francais, and you, the great and comfortable messieurs of the world. Tell me why you have put a gypsy who dresses like tomorrow among the squabbling pimps and thieves of yesterday. He had been in New York one day. One child died at sea. Les Landes, he cried, towering over the enormous room, suddenly one night in autumn. Je les connais comme ma puche Bordeaux. Je sais où que c'est Madrid. Je sais où que c'est Toledo. Seville, Naples. Je suis où le quest. Le juste canne comme ma poche. He could not read. Tell me what it tells, he said briefly, and without annoyance, when once I offered him the journal, and I took pleasure in trying to do so. One fine day, perhaps the finest day, I looked from a window of the enormous room and saw in the same spot that Lena had enjoyed her half-hour promenade during the confinement in the cabinet, as related the wife of the wanderer Nefilska, giving his baby a bath in a pail, while the wanderer sat in the sun, smoking about the pail. An absorbed group of putains stood, several plantons, abandoning for one instant their platonic demeanour, leaned upon their guns and watched. Some even smiled a little, and the mother, holding the brownish, naked, crowing child tenderly, was swimming it quietly to and fro, to the delight of Selina in particular. To Selina it waved its arms greetingly. She stooped and spoke to it. The mother smiled. The wanderer, looking from time to time at his wife, smoked and pondered by himself in the sunlight. This baby was the delight of the putains at all times. They used to take turns carrying it when on promenade. The wanderer's wife at such moments regarded them with a gentle and jealous weariness. There were two girls, as I said. One, the littlest girl I ever saw walk and act by herself, looked exactly like a gollywog. This was because of the huge mop of black hair. She was very pretty. She used to sit with her mother and move her toes quietly for her own private amusement. The older sister was as divine a creature as God, in his skillful and infinite wisdom, had ever created. Her intensely sexual face greeted us nearly always as a descendant pour la soupe. She would come up to B and me slenderly and ask, with the brightest and darkest eyes in the world, "Chocolat, monsieur?" And we would present her with a big or small, as the case might be, morceau de chocolat. We even called her Chocolat. Her skin was nearly sheer gold, her fingers and feet delicately formed, her teeth wonderfully white, her hair incomparably black and abundant. Her lips would have seduced, I think, le gouvernement français itself, or any saint. Well, le gouvernement français decided, in its infinite but unskillful wisdom, that the wanderer, being an inexpressibly bad man, guilty of who knows what gentleness, strength, and beauty, should suffer as much as he was capable of suffering. In other words, it decided, through its three wise men, who formed the visiting commission whereof I speak anon, that the wife, her baby, and her two girls, and her little son, should be separated from the husband by miles, and by stone walls, and by barbed wire, and by law. Or perhaps there was a rumour to this effect, that the three wise men discovered that the father of these incredibly exquisite children was not her lawful husband. And of course, this being the case, the utterly and incomparably moral French government saw its duty plainly, which duty was to inflict the ultimate anguish of separation upon the sinners concerned. I know the wanderer came from La Commission with tears of anger in his great eyes. I know that some days later, along with that deadly and poisonous criminal Monsieur Auguste, and that aged arch-traitor Monsieur Pétez, and that incomparably wicked person Surplice, and a ragged, gentle being who one day presented us with a broken spoon, which he had found somewhere, the gift being a purely spontaneous mark of approval and affection, who for this reason was known as the Spoon Man, and the vast and immeasurable honour of the departing and the Presigni pour les Dures de la Guerre, if ever I can create by some occult process of imagining a deed so perfectly cruel as the deed perpetrated in the case of Joseph Demestri, I shall consider myself a genius. Then let us admit that the three wise men were geniuses, and let us also and softly admit that it takes a good and great government perfectly to negate mercy. And let us, bowing our minds smoothly and darkly, repeat with Monsieur le Curé, toujours l'enfer. The Wanderer was almost insane when he heard the judgment of the Commission, and hereupon I must pay my respects to Monsieur Pedes, whom I had ever liked, but whose spirit I had not, up to the night preceding the Wanderer's departure, fully appreciated. Monsieur Pedes sat for hours at the card table, his glasses continually fogging, censuring the Wanderer in tones of apparent annoyance for his frightful weeping, and now and then himself sniffing faintly with his big red nose, sat for hours pretending to take dictation from Joseph de Maistre, in reality composing a great letter, or series of great letters, to the civil and, I guess, military authorities of Orne on the subject of the injustice done to the father of four children, one a baby at the breast, now about to be separated from all he held dear and good in this world. "I appeal," Monsieur Pedes wrote in his boisterously careful, not to say elegant, script, "to your sense of mercy and of fair play and of honour. It is not merely an unjust thing which is being done, not merely an unreasonable thing, it is an unnatural thing. As he wrote, I found it hard to believe that this was the aged and decrepit and fussing biped whom I had known, whom I had caricatured, with whom I had talked upon ponderous subjects, a comparison between the Belgian and French cities with respect to their location as favouring progress and prosperity, for example, who had with a certain comic shyness revealed to me a secret scheme for reclaiming inundated territories by means of an extraordinary pump of my invention. Yet this was he with the Monsieur Pedes Le Meme, and I enjoyed peculiarly making his complete acquaintance for the first and only time. May the heavens prosper him. The next day the Wanderer appeared in the corps, walking proudly in a shirt of solid vermilion. He kissed his wife, excuse me, Monsieur Melvy, I should say, the mother of his children, crying very bitterly and suddenly. The plantons yelled for him to line up with the rest, who were waiting outside the gate, bag and baggage. He covered his great king's eyes with his long golden hands and went. With him disappeared unspeakable sunlight and the dark, keen, bright strength of the earth. All right, there we go. That's another chapter down. Have your say over at the subreddit. Thank you for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.